Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half here on Premier Christian Radio, with the programme that gets Christians and non-Christians thinking unbelievable. And however you're listening and wherever you are, it's great to have you with me. And if you're listening to this not via our DAB or medium wave services in the UK, but rather via the internet, then why not take the time to visit the Unbelievable website? It's been completely revamped for 2011. There's lots of features, lots of resources, lots of articles there on apologetics and defence of the Christian faith. You can also find the vast archive, as usual, of course, of Unbelievable debate programmes, but you can also search them by theme as well. So if you want to look at all the debates on science and faith, you could go to that one. Or if you want all the debates on Christian doctrine, you could go to that. If you wanted all the debates on Islam, you could find those. It's an easier way to interact with the vast back catalogue of programmes here on Unbelievable. And do get in touch with me via the Facebook and Twitter links that you'll find there. Lots of people now logging on and joining up the Facebook and Twitter community for Unbelievable as well. So look forward to interacting with you that way. The place for all of that is, of course, the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. I've got a very interesting show for you today. Let me tell you what's coming up on Unbelievable.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today's programme is rather special because it's been recorded at the House of Lords. Yes, we've gone to the centre of British politics to bring you today's programme. And with me on the programme today are Oz Guinness. He is a cultural critic. He's a Christian. He's the author of many books. He's an apologist. And he's in conversation today with Lady Mary Warnock, who's a life crossbench peer in the House of Lords. An atheist herself, but she still describes herself as a churchgoer. You'll hear that later on in the programme. They're talking about religious freedom today. And before I introduce them in the House of Lords, let me tell you that their books are well worth getting hold of as well. The Case for Civility is by Oz Guinness, and Dishonest to God is the book we'll be referencing by Mary Warnock. Those are both available at the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Right now, let's go over to that discussion at the House of Lords.
Well, welcome along to this very special edition of Unbelievable, the programme that brings together Christians and non-Christians to talk about the issues of the day in various ways. And my special guests on the programme today, Lady Mary Warnock, Baroness, of course. And we're here at the House of Lords to engage in a discussion today with Oz Guinness, who is a Christian author and cultural critic. Oz is over in the UK, and he's delivering a lecture today in the House of Lords at the time of recording on whether Christian religious freedoms are being neglected in UK society. Baroness Mary Warnock is no stranger to these sorts of issues. Indeed, she's written a book recently, Dishonest to God, subtitled On Keeping Religion Out of Politics. So it should be an interesting meeting of minds today. And I'm looking forward to what we're talking about. We are going to be asking today the question, are Christian religious freedoms being neglected in UK society in the context of what part Christian belief should play in the public arena? And freedom of speech and various moral matters is a contested issue, freedom to wear religious symbols. And of course, your book, Mary, brings up the subject of whether religious morality should any longer, if you like, be tied into our thinking on various social issues, that may be abortion, euthanasia, and other related issues. Well, welcome along both to the programme. First of all, Oz, it's lovely to have you over. You're not resident normally in the UK, though you are of English stock originally, I understand.
Actually, of Irish stock.
Oh, Irish. My apologies. Yeah. Well, the name should have given it away, really, shouldn't it? But Oz, you've sort of made your mark, really, as a cultural critic. You founded the Trinity Forum, which really aims at, if you like, bringing a sort of social renewal through leaders. What brought you initially to the point of coming to this sort of particular role that you have of trying to raise awareness of how faith can make a difference in society?
Well, let me make clear, I'm not talking on the loss of Christian freedom in the UK or in the world. That's not my primary interest. My interest is the world's big question is how do we live with deep differences? And you can see in a world with travel, media, migration, everyone is now everywhere, they say, the challenge of how we negotiate deep differences, especially in public life. That is my passion. And to do that, we need to restore the place of religious liberty, freedom of conscience, and create a new sense of civility between all the differences. That's my concern. So I certainly am a Christian, but I'm not speaking on behalf of Christian liberties. I'm talking on behalf of civility and liberty for everybody.
Mary, I'd be interested just to get a little of your background before we begin the discussion today. What led you into the areas of moral philosophy and those sorts of things originally?
Moral philosophy I was led into by accident, as most things happen by accident. I mean, I became a philosopher teaching in Oxford, and in the 1950s, most male members of the philosophy faculty rather despised moral philosophy. It tended to fall to the women to do most of the moral philosophy teaching, and I always was very much interested in it, particularly in Aristotle, Plato and Aristotle, but also in more modern philosophers like David Hume and Immanuel Kant. So I love teaching moral philosophy, and I've always enjoyed it. But first of all, I'm talking about my background. I certainly describe myself as a Christian. I mean, I'm neither a Muslim nor a Jew nor a Hindu, and I love religion and I go to church. So I think I am Church of England is how I describe myself.
You would describe yourself as church. So, I mean, many people seeing the way that you would like to see as it were, separation of Christian moral belief from society would be surprised to hear that.
Well, my reason for wanting to separate them is not that I don't like, or certainly not that I despise people who found their moral opinions on their religious belief. But I think there is such a large number of people who don't found their moral opinions on any such belief that there's a real danger that if people tend to identify morality with religion, whatever religion, they may throw out the morality with the religion. And my contention is that we absolutely need morality, and I think I probably agree entirely with Oz. We need civility and a way of living together with all our differences. And therefore, we've got to show that morality doesn't necessarily derive from any religion. That is my contention.
Mary, wouldn't we both agree on the need for moral, ethical values in public life?
Absolutely.
That's so important.
Crucial.
And we both agree on the need for civility, including respect and so on, dealing with people of deep differences.
Yes.
But surely you'd also agree that everyone approaches issues of public life from the perspective of their worldview. And some may be atheists, some may be Jews, some may be Muslims, some may be Christians. That's surely the point. You need to allow people of faith or non-faith to speak from the worldview which they hold.
But I don't very much agree with the proposition that you can say faith or non-faith, because my contention is that there is a great deal of shared morality, despite all the differences. There's an enormous body of shared morality if one can dig it out, and therefore if people want to base their political and other views on a morality that can be broadly speaking agreed, I know there are huge differences, but I think we need to search out and dig out the non-differences, the identities with morality, and there is, I think this is partly what the Human Rights Act is trying to do. I mean, I don't like defining morality in terms of rights, but the Human Rights Act is trying to find common moral opinion, beliefs about how one ought never to treat other human beings, and that seems to me a totally worthy aim.
But as a philosopher, wouldn't you say that some of the philosophical roots are ultimate and in some cases irreducible? But you're right, there's an overlapping consensus, as John Rawls says, an overlapping consensus, say between Christians, Jews, Muslims, atheists, on certain points, and those are terribly important. Mm. But there isn't a unity at the level of faith.
Well,
the unity is at the level of ethics and other things in terms of public life.
Well, this is why I think that it's so difficult when people don't assert clearly from which direction they're coming when they utter moral opinions in public. I mean, the Archbishop of Canterbury, whom usually I can't understand one single word he says, but anyway, in this case, I could understand, and I totally agreed, but in an interview for the New Statesman 4 or 5 months ago, he said, of course, people are entitled to utter their moral opinions who have faith of one kind or another. Of course, religious people have that right, but they must declare where they're coming from.
And they must,
and the next thing he said was, and they mustn't expect a free pass on account of their faith. And I think that is absolutely crucial.
Absolutely. But the point is, do they have freedom to enter and engage public life, knowing their faith, their worldview, is rooted, in the Christian sense, in their faith? Now, that's denied by many strict separationists and by a good many secularists. And I think it's very dangerous. I like, for instance, Jürgen Habermas, whom you know from Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
He says that to deny religiously grounded voices is highly illiberal.
And there are many liberals
who are very illiberal today. And
that's why the freedom
of conscience needs to be granted there.
But I think it must be said that coming very near home, for example, in the House of Lords, the bishops, as you know, 26 bishops sit in the Church of England, sit in the House of Lords as of right, and they are treated very often as moral experts. That's to say, if the Bishop of Winchester stands up and says, we mustn't allow assisted dying to the terminally ill, people tend to say, there speaks the voice of religion, of course we mustn't, the voice of morality, so we mustn't. And I think it's this sort of automatic connection of religion with morality that makes people who are not religious feel that they're just not listened to because they haven't got any...
I wouldn't deny for a moment that, say, atheists also have ethics and moral views.
Of course, yes.
Absolutely, I wouldn't deny that for a moment. So some people make the argument that if you don't have faith, you don't have morals, and that's entirely fallacious.
But I think
everyone grounds their ethics in their particular faith. Now, you objected to my use of non-faiths.
Mm.
Well, I actually agree with you.
Yeah.
I was using, in America, secularists don't like to be considered that way.
No.
But I would see secularism, atheism, naturalism, it is a worldview.
Yes.
And of course it has ethics of its own.
Yes, but the other confusing thing, of course, is that you say it has ethics of its own, but most of the ethics of most of us in the English-speaking world or in Europe are grounded in Christianity.
That's right.
Or Judaism and Christianity.
Well, I was going to say, and the question then is, in a sense, where does our ethical, if you like, framework come from? In one sense, is ethics is simply a case of everyone put their hands up and the most people who agree on a certain ethical stance, that's the winner? Is that really the best way of deciding our...
Well, no, because that's an absurd way of describing it. I mean, you don't go around counting heads. You listen to people's arguments and then what moral position you base your... Well, what moral position you adopt is largely based on reason, on thinking. So you don't just look at a show of hands. But I think the other thing is this, that of course everyone in Europe has been brought up in I mean, most people have been brought up in the Judeo-Christian tradition. But the question is really, what is the status of the texts from which this tradition is derived? And I think one either looks at this historically, or one looks at it as a sort of revelation of truth. And I think what our view of the texts, the Old Testament, the New Testament, say, what our view of those is crucially important to this question we're discussing.
Well, I think you can put those together. I mean, I would hold a classical Orthodox Christian faith, which views, say, the Scriptures as revelation, but I also, I'm an Oxford graduate, a DPhil at Oxford, but I also view it critically and thoughtfully and look at all the modern objections raised to it, and I don't see any difference between those. But I'd like to bring in a point, Justin. There's, on the one hand, an enormous diversity of faiths, and we all recognize that today. But on the other hand, you see different models of how faith should be related to public life. And you see supporters of what's called a sacred public square who consider that religion should be preferred in some special way. And the other extreme is what I call supporters of the so-called naked public square, who'd like to see all religion excluded strictly.
Such as the British Humanist Association, they'd like to see, if you like, a secular
country,
basis.
As a country, say, French laïcité, going back to the revolution.
That's
and
right.
You remember the cry of the Jacobin, we want to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. In other words, you had a corrupt church, a corrupt state, throw both of them out together. Mm-hmm. And the French were obviously copied by the Turks under Ataturk and by the communists. And you have the British humanists. In America, you have various secularists. They would like to exclude all religious voices. And as I said earlier, that, I think, is illiberal.
Because in a sense, you don't simply have a vacuum of belief. What it's replaced with is actually a worldview.
Exactly.
Because the secular worldview itself has a number of presuppositions.
But I agree with Lady Warnock strongly. When we ground our views, which are grounded in our faiths and worldviews, as we speak in the public square, we've got to be persuasive. We've got to be publicly accessible. We can't just say religion says, the Bible says, and quote authority to people who don't share that authority.
That is a crucial point.
We have to win arguments.
And surely things are... what you're saying seems to be absolutely right, but it's more acute in America. The situation is more acute in the United States even than it is here, because not because the humanists are more vocal, but because the faith people are more vocal. Isn't that right?
Well, partly. You've had... over the last 30 years, the rise of the religious right.
Right, exactly.
And I've been a strong opponent for 30 years of theirs, unwisdom and their excesses, but they've created a reaction against themselves, and you can see part of the vehemence of the new atheists is a disappointment and a concern about the fact religion is resurgent in our world. As you know, the universities for 200 years expected, take the secularization theory, the more modern we get, the less religious we'd be, and we're not.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Religion is as furiously alive as ever, as Peter Berger says, the sociologist of religion. So we've got to work out how you accommodate religious differences in our public squares. And this is where I'd argue for a new vision of civility.
We'll come back for a response for that in a moment. You're listening to Unbelievable, a special programme recorded today here in the wonderful surroundings of the House of Lords. Perhaps you could just describe which particular hall we're in here, Mary, for the benefit of our listeners.
We're in the robing chamber, which is really terribly underused, because it's used when the Queen opens Parliament. And it is, she comes out of the robing chamber into the chamber where she's wearing, across the Prince's Chamber. There are three of them. And the Prince's Chamber is just a corridor, really, with a few tables in it. And then there's the Debating Chamber. And the Queen comes from here, which is a huge cathedral-like room over across the Prince's Chamber into the debating chamber when she opens Parliament.
Well,
but this
go.
Is only the only sort of formal function that this huge room has. Mm. So here we are sitting at the
well,
table.
Today it's hosting an edition of Unbelievable, the show that gets you thinking every Saturday afternoon and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Perhaps you'd like to contribute your thoughts on today's programme. Please do email me. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'd be pleased to read those out in a forthcoming show.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Coming back to you, Mary, I suppose the problem is that many people would say, yes, it's all very well to say, let's try and get a sense of morality that most people can agree on and that doesn't depend on one particular religious view. But what about these difficult cases where there are Christians who say, my religious rights perhaps should trump someone else's freedom to do something? So I'm thinking, of, for instance, of the charity, the, perhaps a Catholic adoption agency, which doesn't feel it should be forced to put children with homosexual couples or, you know, and it's so, because these stories tend to be so prevalent, again, there's the story of the registrar who says, I would like to be able to, if you like, not have to register marriages between same-sex partnerships.
Yes.
And those people either get, as it were, disallowed or they're fired from their position because that's seen as infringing, if you like, the secular values which this country has come to believe in.
I think the case you mentioned is terribly difficult because the Catholic Adoption Society has done more good in placing children and having good outcomes for adoption, which is very rare, actually. So I think myself that they should not be forced to do something which they believe to be morally wrong. And I think this is a case that probably Oz would take up as a real case.
Strongly agree with you on that.
And I think it is, we are not a secular society, as Oz has just said. We are not. And I don't think we ever will be. And I'm greatly in favour of people being able to say, my religion teaches that homosexual couples, say, should not bring up children. So I think they should be allowed to continue their work, restricted though it may seem to the people who make the laws.
But can they do that in a sense, you know, as a, you know, on behalf of the state? Because if the state says that is a illegitimate view, if the state says that is not a view that can be accepted in society.
But it happens all the time in faith schools, and that is a much more widespread problem.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry,
human rights, in a way, trump the states at certain points, and freedom of conscience certainly should. Mm. To me, it's a sad thing. This country is one of the leading voices historically in establishing freedom of conscience. And the great early pioneers like Roger Williams, like William Penn, these are pioneers. And yet Britain today is casually riding roughshod over issues like this when we should be in the forefront of protecting it. Mm. I live in America. I'll give you an American example, highly politically incorrect. In the old days in America, religious liberty, freedom of conscience, and civil liberty went hand in hand. The gays, the homosexual activists, as a matter of tactics, use civil liberty to trump religious liberty. And now they're saying, in the name of their civil liberties, religious liberty, like you've mentioned, conscience clauses, is an obstruction. They don't realize the logic of what they're saying. Human rights should be inalienable. No one, not even the government, not a majority, not the whims of the people, no one can ride over a right that's a human right. But when the gays say civil liberty trumps religious liberty, it's merely an obstruction, they're saying your traditional liberty is alienable. In other words, they're reducing it to a Nietzschean power game. My power overcomes your power, and so on. This is terribly damaging. And we should see that freedom of conscience, historically, is the first liberty. It underlies freedom of speech, it underlies freedom of assembly, and if it's casually overridden, the orphanage case or whatever, we are all weaker. So I would argue human rights for everybody. We've got to think first principle and establishment very carefully and be very careful when they're overridden.
But there are terrible difficulties, aren't there? I mean, I think more acutely aware of the difficulties that arise out of faith schools, because they, historically, again, they've done, the churches have done incredible things for education. I mean, we wouldn't be education if it weren't for the church schools, and they continue to do extraordinarily good work, it seems to me. But then we are faced with the knowledge that in some, not all, but some Muslim faith schools, things are taught to children which are A, false, but B, extraordinarily damaging to society. So what is the solution? Are we to say no more faith schools, which is what the atheists want? Or are we to say we can pick and choose among the faith schools and so say that some of the things that are taught do override human rights? And I think they do.
This is a slightly different issue we're entering. But two weeks ago in Europe, I was asked to speak on the American motto, A Pluribus Unum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, America's been able to take in a huge number of immigrants so long as, along with the pluribus, the many, they taught the unum. But you've got to know your own national identity and what are the common core values you teach in all the diversity of schools, and then you don't have problems.
But at the moment, is that possible to work? I mean, supposing you take an extreme, I'm very ignorant about Muslim, but I don't know what the extremist Muslim sects are who do set up schools. But if you took various people, would they be persuadable that there is a common core?
Probably not, but the trouble is, even, it appears across the Atlantic, even England is not sure of its common core.
Of course, this is...
And the tragedy is America's not sure today.
No.
Because of the culture warring for the last 50 years. I mean, they used to be able to say, Americans believe in the rule of law, separation of church and state, religious liberty, freedom of speech. You could say 10 things that were taught everywhere, Christian school, whatever the school was. That's disappearing. If you have a unum, you can have an incredible amount of pluribus. In other words, if you have unity, you can have an enormous amount of diversity.
And of course, this
but
is
if you
what
lack
America
unity,
is what has been wonderful.
You're in trouble.
Yes, of course we're in trouble. I think our positions in the United States and here are very much parallel.
Coming closer.
Yes, I think so. But what I would like would be to think that the unum was capable of being, as I said right at the beginning, dug out and identified as
for example, freed in that sense from a religious basis. I mean, I suppose what I want to come to, and we'll take a quick break now because we've come to a break in our program. Yeah. But I'd like just to approach, you know, if we are to say, as your book suggests, Mary, that religion should be discarded as the essential foundation of morality. Well, how do we come to a common agreement on what that morality is? I feel we haven't quite touched on that.
But that is the next thing we'll
come to that in a moment. You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable, which I'm pleased to say is coming from the hallowed surroundings of the robing chamber at the House of Lords. And my guest, both my guests are familiar with this place. Os Guinness is here to deliver a lecture on the issue of religious freedoms in UK society. Lady Mary Warnock is a life crossbench peer here at the House of Lords and is a moral philosopher, has written on a number of other issues as well. Her latest book, Dishonest to God, is subtitled On Keeping Religion Out of Politics. Well, we're in the heart of the centre of politics in the UK here. It's a good place to discuss what the rights and wrongs are of the place of religious freedom in UK society. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Welcome back to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, wherever you are, however you're listening. Thank you for joining me. I'm Justin Brierley, and on today's programme, which brings together Christians and non-Christians, a special edition, you're going to be hearing the continued recording of a discussion I had between Oz Guinness and Lady Mary Warnock at the House of Lords. Let me tell you, though, that their books, The Case for Civility, that's Oz Guinness's book, and Dishonest to God, Mary Warnock's book, available if you click through to the show page of this programme. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And don't forget, there's lots more besides on the newly revamped Unbelievable website, with lots of features, articles and interviews there. And so we continue our discussion on religious freedom.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. My name's Justin Brierley, the host of your programme Unbelievable, that brings together people of varying opinions. Been a lot of a meeting of minds today on the programme between Lady Mary Warnock, who is well known as a moral philosopher in the UK, but her latest book, Dishonest to God, suggests that we should keep religion out of politics. We shouldn't see, if you like, values and morality as stemming simply from a religious belief, but we need to find, as it were, common ground when we look at some of the most pressing issues of our day. Oz Guinness is with me today as well. He's a Christian author and cultural critic, founder of the Trinity Forum, aiming to transform and renew society through the transformation and renewal of leaders. Oz is an evangelical Christian. Mary, I was interested, I wasn't expecting you, in all honesty, to tell me that you were a regular churchgoer, but I'd be interested to know what part does a belief in God, presuming you do have a kind
of... No, I don't think I do.
Okay,
I
have right, well, that's important. Okay, that's an important distinction then. You appreciate then perhaps what Christianity and the Church of England has given, but you don't actually believe in the doctrines per se of the Christian
Church.
No, I think
that's absolutely right. I rarely have been brought up in the Church of England. It's been part of my life, and I'm particularly interested in and adore church music, and I regard the imaginative structure that is Christianity, and is particularly the Church of England, as one of the most wonderful things that the human imagination has ever created. And so that is my position.
But to put a rather dull label on your actual beliefs, as it were, existentially, you would say you would have to say you were an atheist in that sense,
then. No, I would never say I was an atheist, because I believe, I understand, I think, the concept of God, but I don't actually think that there is an identifiable object who takes care of the world or cares about people or created the world in 7 or 20,000 million years. I don't think there is that identifiable object, but the concept of a deity who takes away the faults of the world, you know, that is something that I absolutely love.
Right, you love the concept.
But one final thing is, I think that music and religion are tremendously closely linked, because both of them say things to one, say in inverted commas, that words can't say.
Mm.
So that is why I love the Church of England so much.
I suppose, Oz, your Christian faith, in a sense, does colour the world you live in and will inevitably make a difference to the way you interact with that
world. Well, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ in the full classical, historical sense, although I have worshipped at the Hertford College Chapel in Oxford with Mary and her distinguished husband too, and so I know what she means. And in social sciences, and I'm a social scientist, there's a category of people they call who belong without believing. And what you're saying, Mary, sounds very like that.
That is it.
The point, my argument would be, quite apart from our differences over faith, and we could have a Muslim here or Lord Sacks as a Jewish member of the House of Lords or whatever, there's tremendous diversity today. But I would argue we've got to forge a new vision of public life, which I call the civil public square, in which everyone is free to enter and engage on the basis of their faith, their worldview. And for some it will be atheism, for some it will be Judaism, some be the Christian faith. And thank God, as Mary said, there will be an overlapping consensus. And this is what means society goes forward. But we've got to be free to enter and engage. That's what I'm concerned with. And at the moment, Christians are making a great mistake. They're fighting all the egregious violations, and there are many, whether terrible repressions in China, and they need to be fought, or cases in this country which are outrageous and silly. But if we create a civil public square, and we understand what that is, and the great French theorist Tocqueville, he puts it well, it works when it's a habit of the heart. Mm. You don't just pass it by law. You've got to teach it, parents to their kids, school teachers to their children. When it becomes a habit of the heart, then we all know how to treat each other respectfully. And this is civility, and we need civility to guarantee liberty. That's what I'm concerned
about.
And
this is why the Jesuits are so right in thinking you've got to catechize young to develop these habits. And I do think that the way people teach children, whether they're teachers or whether they're parents, how to behave is enormously important, because this does develop the habit of the heart. I love that
phrase. But that very behaviour will be premised on a set of values that surely will have, as we've said, been shaped by the Christian foundations
of this
country.
Of course, I don't deny that for one moment. What I do deny is that religion is absolutely necessary to people. I think what my position is this, that morality is totally necessary both to individuals and to society if we're going to survive. That is what we absolutely need. Religion is, in my view, something which some people adopt and some people
so
don't.
So that's a personal choice.
But morality is not a personal choice.
No, absolutely. Everyone will have an ethical stance.
Mm. And
but
all, but
people,
know,
the people of faith, their ethics will be rooted in their faith. You sound as if you're saying no faith in the public square. Now, I don't think we should argue about our personal faiths, Christian, Muslim, in the public square. That leads to terrible conflict.
Quite so.
But our public square issues, abortion, euthanasia, the economy, they will all necessarily be rooted in what we believe.
Yes, but how
so you can't
that...
you sound as if you're ruling out all faith in public life.
No, I'm not.
I'm saying you should relate it very carefully.
No, I mean, I don't in the least want to rule out people with strong faith making public utterances, but I want them to say that that is what they have got and not take it for granted.
But you sound as if you are, and I loved what you just said.
Mm.
You said that wonderfully.
But
you're
picked up
by your followers in as if you're arguing for the exclusion of all faith in public life, all religion in public life.
No, I think what I'm arguing for is honesty in the difference between somebody who's speaking from a religious point of view, something almost from a dogmatic point of view, and someone who's speaking not from any.
But is it wrong to, in that sense, speak from a religious point of view?
Not as long as you say that that's what you're doing.
Okay. Exactly.
If you are a Roman Catholic who has been taught and who truly believes that the life of a pre-14-day embryo is just as important as the life of a grown human being, if you have been taught and believe that, then you must say that that is your dogmatic faith, because other people who are perfectly moral in their beliefs and their intentions and their aspirations don't believe that and can't believe it. You can't tell someone to believe something if they don't believe
it. No, of course not. And you can't impose it on them.
No.
You've got to win the arguments. And I always say the example of William Wilberforce. When he first stood against slavery, he was defeated.
Yeah.
20 years, year after year after year, defeated. And then he won. We have to be persuasive, and we've got to eventually prevail in public life with apologetic arguments that are powerful.
I mean, you've caused some controversy in the past with statements concerning euthanasia and assisted dying yourself, Mary, and you've suggested in the past that there is perhaps a moral case for those who are a burden on their families at a very advanced stage of illness to choose to have their life terminated.
Strongly.
You believe that strongly. Now, obviously, Oz probably differs on that front. And the question is, well, whose morality is the right one? Is there a right morality? Is it simply that we have to sort of come to some kind of meeting point
is absolutely right, and it's such an important issue, and I think you must be thankful to find something that I don't agree about, but I think my argument on this particular issue is that we morally ought to rethink what we mean by human life and a life, a good life, that is worth living for somebody. And this is going to take a very long time. I suspect that my argument will fail in the end, but this is not an anti-religious argument, because I believe that you could and have, I have, I think, persuaded some people who are religious that when somebody is terminally ill, going to die anyway, agreed to be going to die, knows they're going to die, then they should be allowed to choose perhaps to meet their God sooner rather than later. That's the way they like to put it. And I don't believe that this is an anti-religious argument.
But it will conflict with people's religious views. I mean,
of course it does.
Presumably your views on this will stem inevitably from your beliefs about God and about life and being made in the image of God. I mean, what would your response be to this particular issue and how Mary sees that it should be played out in the public sphere?
Well, in terms of what we're talking about today, and clearly Mary and I disagree on that, and I think it's important to leave the end of life into God's hands, and when we don't, there really is a slippery slope, and too many people have died, say, in Holland, and in our... But that's not my point today. But Mary, I'm not arguing the pros and cons of euthanasia today. What I'm arguing is a vision of public life in which all these voices can come in. And the point is, at the end of it, this is where your hands raised, 51% will always prevail. And as I said, Wilberforce was voted out. Slavery was defended until eventually he prevailed by being persuasive. And thank God he did, and abolition of slavery came in. Now, in the case of euthanasia or abortion, one or other will always win. 51% will prevail. My argument today is we've got to have a civil, open public square so that all the diversity of voices are free to enter. Now, we differ over this one, but that's my point, not my point today. My point is the public square that allows people to enter and engage.
Yeah. Well, I agree with this, and I entirely agree with your example of Wilberforce, and I think we simply differ, not simply, but we do differ on which view about the very end of the life of the terminally ill will in the end prevail. And I mean, I'm perfectly prepared to argue, to agree, that some of the arguments put forward to hasten the time when the terminally ill are allowed to die if they want to, that some of the arguments put forward will be suspect. I mean, it's to do with finance and whether we can afford to keep all these people who are barely conscious and don't want to go on living anyway. And these arguments, they come and sort of muddy the waters. But there still is a moral argument. Mm-hmm. And as you say, one view is bound to prevail in the end. Mm-hmm. And you and I would argue publicly.
But where even something like, you're well known for saying we can have a common morality on the basis, say, of human rights.
Or
on the basis of common needs.
Yes, common needs, yes.
But even, you love Aristotle. As you know, Aristotle said we care, quote, for people like us. In other words, the Greek view of caring had strict limits.
Yeah,
the family for the family, clan for the clan,
yes,
and so on. What made the difference and characterized our Western civilization is Jesus.
Yes, that's right.
The parable of the Good Samaritan.
Which is my...
It crosses the boundaries.
Of course it is. I mean, the parable...
And this is where the roots of things are so important.
But you see, I think that the parable of the Good Samaritan is my idea of the foundation of morality. And it comes in the New Testament. I don't deny it. But my belief is this, that the human imagination, which, first of all, recognized that morality was absolutely essential for any society, and that it was a matter of aspiration, not of our actually following a lot of rules and doing the proper thing, but of always attempting to do better, always seeing that we were failing, and so on. That human imagination also devised the mythology of religion and the telling of parables and the way of dramatizing things by talking about Moses going up to Mount Sinai and receiving the Ten Commandments. These were the stories, the narratives, that got people to accept morality. I think morality comes first, religion comes afterwards.
But, I mean, I would suggest perhaps that, another person would have the view that, well, you're suggesting, therefore, that, morality is in some way invented, discovered as we go along. Obviously, a Christian might say, actually, the morality has always existed. It's simply that we have either been able or failed to, as it were, discover it and, appropriate it for ourselves.
Wait a minute. Would the Christian say that? I thought morality...
Well, I don't think... Oz, well, let's have your view. Well, what is morality,
as
it were?
I would say rights and wrongs are innate. Every human we discover will eventually say something's right, something's wrong. Mm. The question is, how do you ground them? For people of faith, they are grounded ultimately in our worldviews, and mine is certainly grounded in the Christian faith.
Yes, but the Christian faith is very specific.
No, but you're, as it were, deconstructing the faith and demythologizing it. You're not describing it in a way that faithful Christians would describe their own faith.
No, because they have this one thing that I don't have, which is the belief, which we really started with, that the Old and the New Testament together are revelation from
then,
God.
You know, that's a much wider question. Justin, bring us back for another discussion on that.
Well, I mean,
but that you'd have to ask me why I believe that.
Yes, yes.
And if we had the time for that, I could give you fully rational reasons.
It's completely essential. If I don't understand why you believe that the New Testament, let's take that, because the Old Testament presents all kinds of difficulties. The New Testament is revealed morality. If that's what you believe, I want to know why you believe it.
And if the program was on that, we could get into that. That's not our topic today.
That would require a whole program of its own. But what I think...
What interests me today is that all these things, human rights, ethics, and so on, are grounded in faith. You take, say, John Gray, the philosopher. He rightly points out that the optimistic humanists of our time have a faith that is parasitic on the Christian faith.
Well, you see, that's exactly what I think. I reverse. I think the Christian faith is parasitic on human nature, and human nature demands morality.
That is obviously your belief and your point of view. The question is it then condescending, in a sense, to say to a person who believes actually that beliefs and the values and morality are actually grounded in God himself, is it then condescending to say, well, I'm afraid you're simply wrong about that, and actually we have to understand that this is something which is just simply something that arose from our evolutionary, you know, ancestors or something like that, and therefore your view, you know, quaint as it is, should be rejected in terms of its value in the public sphere.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that your views should be rejected. I am saying...
Mary, you're quoted that way.
I know I am.
I'd love you to clear it up as it were publicly.
What I actually am saying is, do have your faith and do grant your morality in your faith, but please say that that's what you're doing, because then I can ask you what the morality is and where
and
it
comes
from.
You ask Oz, for instance, to justify why he believes that his morality should be based on a revealed...
Yes, but I don't even mind his not refusing to answer that question, as long as he doesn't say, I've got to believe it too, otherwise I won't have any morality.
I've never said that. Atheists are moral.
Right.
There's no question.
And
all humans
said, they all
have their ethical position. Everyone does. But they lead in different directions. If you and I both probably radically agree, you say disagree with Herbert Spencer.
Yes,
applying
yes.
evolution in a heartless way, the survival of the fittest, yeah. It was cruel and heartless.
Absolutely.
In other words, your faith will have consequences. And I would argue differences make a difference. And it's no accident, say the Christian faith, you can dismiss it, Mary, but the Christian faith gave us the rise of human rights because humans are made in the image of God. And one of the big questions, say, for tomorrow's Human Rights Day, the 62nd anniversary of the Universal Declaration. And it's surrounded with controversy today. What's the basis of why a human has inherent dignity? Now,
well,
Christians know why. Follow Peter Singer, you know, the Princeton philosopher, humans are no different from animals. Well, obviously they don't have human rights. So I think the differences make a difference, and they're terribly important. That's why they should be allowed to speak in,
well, of course,
in the public square.
I'm
so glad you agree
saying,
with that.
Oh, I absolutely
you are quoted
agree.
That way. I mean, and I'm so glad
if
you
I could
clear
just read the you know what's written you know in relation to the book when I picked it up at Amazon. This is the way that the website describes it. That Mary argues that religious and theological issues should have no place in issues of public morality. I mean. But I suppose it depends on your definition of what having no place in
exactly,
issues of public morality
exactly.
is. You say we should be honest about where we're coming
yes,
from.
Yes, yes.
It sounds a little bit like when you say that, though, Mary, that if I then say, well, I believe this because I'm a Christian and I believe that this is the revealed truth,
yeah.
Then that is somehow going to then be discounted because that's going to be seen as biased, as somehow non-neutral in a way that your beliefs aren't.
I don't think my beliefs are neutral, because I believe very strongly in the morality of some things and the immorality of others. I never would stand back and say I take a neutral position with regard to torture. Of course I don't. I'm passionately against anybody torturing anybody. So, no, I'm not neutral. But I think that being hostile to torture is a human value, and I think it's something that human beings ought never to do to one another. So do most Christians. But I don't think that they can say that their belief is any stronger or any more valid, so to speak, than mine.
Well, I agree with that. The question of which is true and so on is not a public square issue.
No.
We should argue those in private. And
yeah.
we obviously could have a wonderful discussion of that. But the public question is of the social consequences of what it is we're believing and arguing for. Take, say, a practical example of the American discussion today of marriage. Christians make the mistake of going into the public square and say, gay marriage is wrong because the Bible says so. Well, people who are atheists or don't read the Bible, that's a ridiculous argument.
Right, it isn't an argument.
It's a Christian authority. It's not persuasive. So Christians have to say, I believe this, out of my biblical background. But we have to argue for public policy reasons that a gay marriage or whatever, disastrous consequences for the children,
and
give publicly accessible, persuasive arguments for why we have a different vision. That's what I call for.
Yes, you see, if we go back to the case of euthanasia, it struck me, while all this debate was going on in this place, that the Christians, even the people dressed up as Christians and bishops, they started off by saying human life is sacred. And they didn't say it because the Bible says so, but they said things like being made in God's image and all that. And then they quickly left that. I mean, they got a passing mention, if any, because immediately they went on, just as you advocate, to the utilitarian arguments, what the consequences would be in real empirical terms if the law were changed. And that was what they based their arguments on. But because they were Christians, because they had these white robes and looked so grand, people deferred to them in a way that they weren't entitled to.
Well, Mary, I agree with that, that there's no deference to a white robe. Public policy victory should be for the most persuasive arguments.
And these are utilitarian arguments, broadly speaking.
In other words, they're rooted in principle.
Yes, they are.
But in the public square, of course, the consequential, utilitarian, that's the
important thing. To be a politician, to be a legislator, you've simply got to be a consequentialist. You've simply got to think of consequentialism.
Of course, because you're dealing with issues of common. We go back to the Greek agora. We come into the agora, or the Roman forum, to discuss issues of common public life that matter to us all. So the consequences are absolutely fundamental.
Yeah. So therefore, this is one of your playing at my hands, in the sense that if you've got to take the consequences into account, then you are leaving, for the time being, the absoluteness of the religious.
You're leaving the absoluteness, but you're not leaving the links.
Yeah.
In other words, my faith is rooted in things I believe absolutely true. Say, human dignity.
Yeah.
I believe every person, however badly impaired psychologically, poorly educated, however poor, made in the image of God, he or she is precious.
Well, I agree with
that's
all
absolute.
Of that, except made in the image of God.
No, I see.
I absolutely believe it all.
But if you have, say, a Hindu view,
Yeah.
The caste system, the untouchables are nothing.
No, that's right.
And it's the imageness of God, for me.
But let me finish, Mary.
For me personally, is why the untouchable has dignity. But that's also historically why it came in. It didn't come in from the Enlightenment.
No.
It came in from the Christian understanding.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
Of humans
and
made in the image of God.
Is that I think that human beings made in the image of God is the most marvelous, imaginative metaphor. And that is my belief.
But metaphor of what?
Metaphor
in
for
other
the
words, I believe it is
complete importance of treating every human being as ultimately equal.
But you're
you say equal in the eyes of God. And there was a time when it was terribly difficult for me not to use this religious language, and that was when I was chairing a committee on the education of severely disabled children way back in the 1970s. And it would have been so easy to say why we are insisting that these children be educated, which they never had been before, was because we are all God's children. Wonderful if I could have said that. But of course, on a government committee, you can't say this. You've got to think of something else. And the answer came out as something to do with equality.
Well, absolutely. The point is, though, where does our foundation for equality come from? For me, it's very difficult to get away from some sense that we have some divine imprint, which is what these rights are based on.
Otherwise, we are the
Peter Singer animals, that simply byproducts of evolution, which have no inherent value.
You say imagination. Say Peter Singer's imagination prevailed,
yeah.
Or Herbert Spencer's prevailed,
yes.
Or the Brahmin castes prevail. Where would we be?
Well, where would
in
we
other words,
be,
equality.
And this is why
equality has to have a content. You have to be equally free or equally. Have dignity or
equally,
whatever.
Well, have dignity, equally important. Equally
we'll have to just take a quick break, I'm afraid, again, and we're just going to wrap up with just 5 minutes to conclude our discussion. But it's been fascinating so far. We've been holding this, a special edition of the programme, in the surroundings of the House of Lords. Mary Warnock is with me. She's a baroness and a life crossbench peer here, and has been very influential when it comes to issues surrounding whether religious values should have a place in deciding certain social issues such as euthanasia, abortion. We've been talking about that alongside Os Guinness today, who's a Christian author and cultural critic over from the States and doing a little bit of talking over in the UK in regards to how religious freedoms should be, as it were, spoken for in UK society today. So do join us again in just a few minutes' time as we conclude our discussion on today's programme.
Welcome back to Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians thinking every week here on Premier Christian Radio and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you're not my Facebook friend via the Unbelievable group on Facebook, or indeed follow on Twitter, and you can do that, why not check it out? Go to the Unbelievable website there and you can follow the links through to both those places. And it's been fun to be in contact with people via Twitter and Facebook in the last couple of weeks. Lots of interesting ideas coming through for different show sort of ideas and things like that from people that I've been in touch with. But we still take the traditional method of email, and I'll be reading out a number of your emails, particularly in regard to last week's show, very popular show, with William Lane Craig reviewing his debate with Richard Dawkins in Mexico. So that's still to come. Next week on the programme, we start a series of programmes looking at the Bible. It is the 400th anniversary this year of the publication of the King James Version. Well, obviously, since then, many more translations of the Bible have been made, and we're going to be looking at the whole area of Bible translation next week. I'm going to have in the studio with me Don Horrocks from the Evangelical Alliance here in the UK. He's going to be in conversation with atheist Norman Hansen, who was a Christian but abandoned his Christian faith. They're going to be asking, is the Bible too subjective when it comes to translation for Christians to be able to base their beliefs reliably upon it? Norman is of the view that a lot of what we get from the Bible is entirely dependent upon the way that the translator chooses to bring its message across, and we'll be looking at issues around how we translate the original documents of the Bible and the many translations that one can find these days. That's all to come next week. Do hope you can tune in for that as well. For the moment, let's go back to the final part of today's programme at the House of Lords.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, welcome back to the House of Lords. This is, of course, the centre of British political life. And we're talking about an issue that touches on the way politics and religion should interact. Today, my guest, Oz Guinness, a Christian author and cultural critic, founder of the Trinity Forum in the United States, aiming for the transformation and renewal of society through that same process in leaders. Lady Mary Warnock, also with me, who is a British philosopher. An interesting background, she told us about her love for Christianity, the church, church music in particular, but that is a metaphor in her mind, she doesn't hold to any particular faith belief that, as it were, undergirds that. We've been asking today, well, where does our morality for the public sphere come from then? Is it simply a case of a democratic vote on which morality is correct? Are there certain rights when it comes to religious beliefs which should be, as it were, looked at and adhered to? I suppose many people will say, yes, it's all very well having the freedom to have this sort of every voice heard in the public sphere. The question comes, Oz, I suppose, is when one voice does eventually prevail, a course of action has to be set, laws have to be put into motion. What happens to the Christian who feels that they have been neglected in some sense, that they cannot...
It's not just the Christian. We're used to that democracy. You've got a coalition government now. Labour was last time. In America, the Democrats are in. Last time was Republican. We're used to the fact, after every election, one party's won, one party's lost, and you hope you do better next time. We all know that. And as I said, with Wilberforce, it was 20 years of failure, till he won his argument, and thank God, abolition prevailed and slavery was abolished. And we've got to see all our arguments for that. If Mary wants to argue for hers, I want to argue for mine. We've got to enter the public square and, by God's grace, hope that our arguments are persuasive and eventually prevail. But my argument today is somewhat different. The whole world is now suffering from this challenge. How do we live with deep differences? And we can't blow ourselves off the planet or have endless conflict and tension. And the way out is not interfaith dialogue. The way out is to create visions of civil public life in which everyone understands their rights, respect for others, and then the responsibility of civility. So we engage each other respectfully. And then you create a climate in which democracy and so on can really flourish. Everyone has freedom, but there is justice. That's my concern today. Now, if you invite Mary and me on to discuss our faiths, another time, obviously.
Another time.
She is more than willing, and I would be more than willing, but that's not today's discussion.
Sure.
And we've got to know what it is we're discussing. Yeah, we're
absolutely
discussing public life.
Mm.
Yes, and this is what... And I think the whole of the issue of faith in public life has become increasingly urgent, both within the United States, for example, over the kind of abortion issues and the kind of aggressive behavior of non-faith people against faith people and so on. But worldwide, I think we can't overlook the appalling state we're in over theocracies and terrorism. I mean, this is really something we keep shutting our eyes to, but it goes on.
Absolutely.
And it's absolutely frightening to me. So, I mean, the call that we should somehow be able to accommodate one another's beliefs is incredibly urgent, and I absolutely agree with Oz on that. I just don't quite see how it's to be done, how we can accommodate extremist views of extremist theocratic states which genuinely want to eliminate other states which don't share their theocracy.
Here's a proposal, Mary. 62 years ago, the Universal Declaration. It was moral suasion, followed by legal implementation, and then civic education. And while the world doesn't all follow it, we've had Rwanda, we've had Srebrenica, etc., etc., it's been a moral beacon in the world. Mm. And I think we need to do the same for freedom of conscience and civility. In other words, a global declaration of the freedom of conscience for everybody, spelling out what civility means, and it will take leaders in a position, like here in Parliament, to put something like that out for the world.
Yes.
And my longing is that England, which was the great early champion of freedom of conscience.
Of course, the Mayflower.
We should have spokeswomen and spokesmen here. That's my suggestion.
Yes, well, it's a wonderful suggestion. The only thing is that we have to keep reminding ourselves of the persistence of the Wilberforces of the world, because how are we going to persuade Iran, for example, that stoning a woman for adultery is no way of civil behaviour?
But if you look at the world, surely the English-speaking democracies or the Western European nations, we have the first principles in our history and so on. We need to use them to forge a new vision of a better way. Mm. Now, it'll take a long while before the Middle East is profoundly touched, right, let alone the Taliban. But we've got to start here. England's not doing well at the moment. Mm. That's the tragedy.
We've had a fascinating discussion. Thank you both for joining me on the programme today. And thank you for hosting us here, Mary, at the House of Lords. If you want to get hold of Mary's book, it's available in many good bookshops via Amazon. And I'm going to post a link to it with the podcast of this programme.
My book is called The Case for Civility.
The Case for Civility by Os Guinness, also available. And I'm going to post a link up to that as well. So if you want to check back for that, do visit the show webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. It's been a great pleasure having you both on, and I trust you'll have a good rest of the trip while you're over here, Oz. Thank you for being with us today, Mary.
Great.
Well, it was wonderful to spend time with Oz and Lady Mary Warnock there in the rather grand surroundings of the robing chamber at the House of Lords. I hope you enjoyed the programme. Don't forget you can email with your comments. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And I look forward to reading some of those out in just a moment's time. If you want to phone and leave a voicemail message, that's also possible. 08456 52 52 52 and select option 8. So we're going to hear some of your feedback now here on the programme that gets you thinking.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, last week's programme has proved to be very popular. Lots of people downloading that and responding to it in one way or another. It was William Lane Craig, one of the foremost defenders of Christian faith in the world. He was on the phone and he was talking about his debate at the end of 2010 with Richard Dawkins, one of the most high-profile atheists in the world. They were debating, does the universe have a purpose? And Bill was on a bench of theists, and Richard Dawkins on a bench of atheists, and everyone had a turn speaking. It wasn't a one-on-one debate, and as we said in the programme, we'd still like to see that happen between Bill and Richard Dawkins, but a number of you wanted to comment on the way that programme went. Carl Udy, who I know has joined the Unbelievable Facebook and Twitter pages, wants to get in touch. He says, thanks for putting together these shows every week. I've been listening for a couple of years now and find the debates to be thought-provoking while remaining civil. I was interested to hear the latest show, some excerpts from the debate, including William Lane Craig and Richard Dawkins, and that Dawkins considered Peter Atkins' quote that the why questions are silly questions to be worth repeating, because to me it would seem to be one of those embarrassing quotes that no atheist would want being brought up, similar to such candid quotes as Aldous Huxley's, that his atheism afforded him a justification for his sexual behaviour. My eyebrows were raised even further when it was mentioned that the problem of evil and suffering was one of the arguments against theism brought forward by the atheists in the same debate, because surely to say that the why questions are silly questions is to relegate any questions about evil and suffering to the ridiculous. However inadequate an atheist finds a Christian explanation of evil and suffering, the idea that it's just a silly question surely must be even more inadequate. I found it even more incongruous when Richard Dawkins went on to characterise theists as lying down and pathetically saying, well, we don't understand it, so God did it. Does he not see the irony when he's effectively saying, well, we don't understand it, so it's a silly question? Thanks for the show, says Carl. Thank you for being involved, Carl. This one from David says, I listened to the show between William Lane Craig and Dawkins. As I listened to both sides of the argument without bias or prejudice, I must say that Richard Dawkins' arguments were very weak. The reality is this: he is a gifted intellectual in the scientific realm, but not in the philosophical realm. And his philosophical thinking ability was shown to be naive by the more experienced philosopher. I can see why Dawkins would want to avoid debating with William Lane Craig. Now, there was a little bit of controversy over the format of last week's programme. Obviously, here on Unbelievable, the bread and butter of the show, as it were, is Christians and non-Christians coming together in dialogue, as we heard on today's programme. So that perhaps explains why Oliver Tress emails me to say, "Naughty, naughty, Justin. You let your high standards slip here. I'm constantly impressed by your ability to act as a mediator between the two opposing sides of a debate. However, I had a sense of dread when I heard the format for this show, and sadly my fears were realised. This show with Craig was nothing less than propaganda. Perfect for evangelical radio shows, of which I'm sure there are many, but totally unsuitable for your show, given your stated aims of engaging in fundamental questions on Christianity with the intention to openly discuss different opinions between Christians and non-believers. The balance offered by airing both sides of any position is what makes your show refreshing and interesting. Listening to Craig give his unchallenged version of events is neither. I felt similarly about the interview with Professor Penrose debunking Stephen Hawkins, and for that matter, Alistair McGrath's contribution in the same show. These one-sided formats do not belong on the Unbelievable slot, in my opinion. I should finish by saying that, of course, I wouldn't send this email if I wasn't a big fan. So fear not, I will keep listening and appreciating your work, unless, of course, these one-sided shows become the norm, which seems unlikely. If you feel miffed that I'm holding you to a high standard, then please take it as a compliment. Thank you very much. I do take it as a compliment, Oliver, and as I've said already when I replied to your email, you can expect the normal service to be resumed, as it were, in general. Though you'll appreciate if I occasionally indulge in a more one-sided affair, particularly when it's a sort of a reviewed style programme. Anyway, Jerry Adams wanted to say that I've been listening to Unbelievable for a couple of years now. I must say it's one of the best programmes on radio. Thank you very much, Jerry. I haven't contacted the programme before, but your episode with the affably disingenuous William Lane Craig has forced me to comment. This episode suffered from there being no balancing view from a non-believer. So Jerry here echoing the sentiments of Oliver. Craig is very clever and very skilled debater. His rhetoric is carefully crafted to hammer his point home. Unfortunately, your obvious dislike for Richard Dawkins' views plus your obvious admiration for Craig meant he was allowed to run riot and the programme was exceptionally partial. After listening to this programme, I listened again to the debate. I'm amazed at the misrepresentation of the debate given by Craig, sadly aided and abetted by yourself. It was Craig at the beginning of the debate who opened with a highly emotional and subjective statement about the scientific fact that the universe is doomed to end. The theist side all introduced emotional points before Dawkins responded. And during the debate and during the programme, Craig claimed that Dawkins introduced the emotional note. Well, that's not the case. Craig, in his opening comments, introduces the emotional reaction. It is Craig who introduces the emotive terms chunks of matter, nothing but matter in motion. Life is absurd without meaning or purpose, amongst other emotive rhetoric. Afraid I don't have time to read all of the email, Jerry, but I do take your point that obviously you prefer the balance that normally exists on this programme. As to whether it was highly emotional, I mean, in a sense, the statement that Craig made about the universe running down, eventually experiencing heat death, is a purely scientific statement. That is a fact that any scientist worth his salt will agree on. I suppose it has an emotional impact, though. And of course, there was, in some sense, it was intended to show that this shows that there is no ultimate purpose to the universe. That was the whole point of why Bill Craig mentioned it. I would say, though, that he did make it explicit, as was pointed out in that video mix that I featured of Peter Byram's, that he wasn't using that as an argument for God. And that's the difference. That's what Dawkins accused him of, using an emotional argument for God. On the contrary, Craig said very explicitly, none of this proves that God exists. It was other arguments that he referenced that he would say prove that God exists. Anyway, thank you, Jerry. Sorry I can't read more of your email at this time, but if I get time on another programme, perhaps we'll do that again. Talking about emotional arguments for the existence of God or against God, this is from Paul McCauley, who says, really enjoyed the interview with Bill Craig. I just wanted to make a point on Dawkins' statement decrying emotional arguments. Not only was this attack without justification, but it is a shocking example of double standards, because Dawkins is the king of the emotional argument. His book, which sets out to divest the world of belief in God, seeks to accomplish its mission by calling God names and accusing him of being a not very nice person. Anyone even half awake will will see that the opinion of Dawkins that the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all of fiction has nothing to do with whether he actually exists. But why engage with the evidence when he can outrage the emotions? Sure, it saves him having to do anything like research, allows him to avoid the scholarly work supporting Christianity, and frees him to string together more zingers of insults to God. If Dawkins is right to deride people for believing in something for purely emotional reasons, he maybe ought to remove the plank from his own eye before he tries picking the speck out of a Christian's, because he's more guilty than most of using emotional arguments. Maybe he needs to summon some courage and face the facts honestly. He may find they point to the God he seems to hate so much. Finally, here's Jason, who says, I'm surprised that you've never got William Lane Craig onto the show to do an actual debate, Justin. On one of his podcasts, Craig has hinted that he might be coming to England later this year, and so maybe you could get Craig to pop into the Unbelievable studio whilst he's in London. Well, it's funny you should mention that, Jason. I am, in fact, on a small group that are actually involved in bringing William Lane Craig over to England next year, as he hinted at in one of his recent podcasts. So you can expect a proper full-blown debate in various ways here on the programme in due course. But I can't reveal much more about that. Things are still being worked out. But yes, more to come on that. You also wanted to say, Jason, that I would be looking at presuppositional apologetics again on the show. And if you do, maybe I could get an evidentialist in and discuss the claim that a non-presuppositionalist approach is in some way inferior. That would be interesting. I don't do this show to, as it were, debate apologetics. I do apologetics debate. In a way, it's interesting. I don't know. Maybe that steers us too far away from what this program is actually about, though. Nonetheless, thank you for your interest in this whole area, Jason. Let's go to some of your emails on other subjects, past programs. The Christmas Cracker, a couple of weeks ago, Christmas Day edition of the program. L.A. Callahan emails to say, I just listened to that show. I'm always interested in hearing a subject fairly discussed, so I was looking forward to this discussion on the origins of Christmas. There was one line of reasoning, though, which I didn't hear discussed, though it seems vitally relevant. That is, whether or not early Christians, or early Jews, for that matter, celebrated birthdays in general. Unless I'm wrong, there seems to be no scriptural indication that either group did. Conversely, evidence that birthdays were celebrated by pagan cultures is solid, as reflected in a statement by the Encyclopedia Americana. The ancient world of Egypt, Greece, Rome and Persia celebrated the birthdays of gods, kings and nobles. And you say the conclusion seems to be that pagan cultures definitely celebrated birthdays and early Christians and early Jews probably did not. Sorry, early Christians and early Jews probably didn't. A very interesting question that would preempt the whole discussion of Christmas would be the origins of the birthday celebration. If, as the World Book Encyclopedia says, the early Christians considered the celebration of anyone's birth to be a pagan custom, then the probability of them celebrating Christ's birth would be very small. Well, that's an interesting sort of way of looking at it. I'm not sure the evidence stacks up against, in that way, I don't know, Christmas being a genuinely early church phenomenon or not, because early Christians and early Jews weren't known for celebrating birthdays. Perhaps they weren't. I mean, but the birth of the founder of your religion probably would merit maybe a change in approach, just on that one occasion at least. Anyway, that's certainly deaths were obviously commemorated. I'm not sure about births, but yeah, worth looking into. Certainly if we do Christmas again, I'll put that to our guests. Liam, thank you very much. Okay, have we got time for a couple more? This is someone who wanted to talk about the Grilla Christian Part 2 show of a month or two back. This was David Robertson answering the questions of various sceptics. You say here, Bob, that I was saddened as a Christian hearing David's answers about why God sends people to hell and about why pray if God is all-knowing. To be fair, you need to tell your listeners that there are reformed and more consistent answers to these questions. At least have James White answer the same questions and show that there are two Christian views to these difficult answers. You always seem to default to the Arminian position, which is so inconsistent. How sad for the Christian side, as it makes the sceptic look good, whereas his objections can be reduced to absurdity if reformed theology were used in answering those two questions. Interesting you should say that, because David Robertson, who was the guest answering the questions on that occasion, is definitely reformed in my book, though you obviously saw his answers as leaning more on Arminian theology than reformed theology, though though I think if you asked him about his theology, he'd say definitely in the Reformed Calvinist end of the spectrum. You mentioned James White. He's coming on the programme in a few weeks' time, not to talk about those issues. We're going to be looking at the King James Version of the Bible, and he's going to be interacting with a King James Version onlyist. Those are people who believe that the King James Version is the only proper right version to use in the English language of the Bible. It is, of course, the 400th anniversary this year of the publication of the King James Version Bible, and so we're going to be doing a number of shows looking at it in various ways. Probably that's a good point at which to tell you what's coming up on the show next week. Let me tell you what we're doing as we kick off a few weeks looking at the Bible.
You're unbelievable.
Well, next week we're going to be talking about translations of the Bible. And, well, since the King James Version was published some 400 years ago, there is now a proliferation of different translations of the Bible. But some sceptics say, if anything, all that shows us is that the Bible is very subjective when it comes to the way we interpret its meaning. So you have, if you like, conservative interpretations of certain Bible passages in certain versions of the translations, and you have more liberal ones in others, and these views... Well, which Bible, we're asking next week, which Bible is the Bible when it comes to the various translations we have? And helping us to look at that will be Don Horrocks. He's from the Evangelical Alliance here in the United Kingdom. And also skeptic Norman Hansen will be on hand as they discuss which Bible is the proper Bible on the show that gets you thinking next week. Hope you can be with me from 2:30 p.m. here on Premier Christian Radio and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.